Welcome to Hazard Class, the podcast created for and about you, the emergency responder.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jesse Taylor.
I'm Dave Godin.
And I am Mark Norman.
And this is Hazard Class, the show where if you're not careful, you just might learn something.
That's exactly right, JT. And in that first show that we did, we really just introduced ourselves, right? Kind of said who we were and what the show is about. We covered the evolution of field technology since the early 2000s in about 9 minutes, which was pretty ambitious. But you know, guys, what I was thinking, it was sort of like the first day of class. Like you go to take a college class, for example. We've all been to college, right? And right. Yeah, that first day, the professor just introduces himself or herself. Yeah, here's who I am. You know, they hand out the syllabus, right? They say, here's what we're going to cover. They, you know, tell you what books you got to get and all that. They don't really cover anything specific. They just kind of introduce, but maybe they give you a reading assignment. And that's kind of like that first trivia question. Does that make sense?
I feel like I got yelled at a lot more on my first couple of days of school, but we'll roll with that analogy.
Well, you went to the military academy, so I'm sure they have.
There were way fewer push-ups done on this podcast, for sure.
So, JT, I don't know if that analogy makes sense to you, but that's how I felt. We just kind of got things started, but today we're getting into something specific. Before we get into that, Alyssa, our program director, she was a little annoyed that we went just over 30 minutes. So there you go.
Not far though.
Not far, but she is a stickler. So we're going to do our best, but this show,
she'll keep us in line.
She'll do our best. And again, keep that sheet of not what to say in front of you. Cause we have a lot of interesting stuff today. We're going to talk about white powder calls. We're actually going to talk in one block sort of about the white powder calls of yesterday and then sort of how it evolved into white powder calls of today, really from anthrax to fentanyl. But before we get into that, JT, we got to get into answer the question, the trivia question from last week's episode. And folks, if you did listen, the question was who developed the five-step method for field qualitative identification of unknowns. So JT, do you know the answer?
Absolutely. You remember this, guys? The five-step method, the Dieter Hines five-step method.
Absolutely. Dieter Hines. And Dave, you had said you'd used it in the field.
Well, absolutely. He actually came out and trained my unit prior to our deployment to Iraq. And so my entire chemical company or battalion, at least a portion of it, was able to attend his class. And he's the reason that I'm unreasonably afraid of hydrofluoric acid, actually. He had so many horror stories to tell.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so not only did he use it, you met the man.
I did. And his family carried on teaching through that method for some time. Are they still active or has it been more or less retired at this point?
You know, I don't know. Unfortunately, he passed away a few years ago. But yeah, certainly the method lives on. And I believe his son or his family has been continuing to do stuff. So, it just goes to show the power of basic qualitative analysis, right? And what it can you do? Again, we talked about technology. We're going to talk a lot about technology over, you know, the course of this podcast. But you can't get away from that simple stuff, right?
Absolutely.
All right.
So very good.
Basic fundamentals.
We did have some winners. We actually had 10 correct answers submitted. Unfortunately, we only had one set of steak knives, so we're going to send one knife to each person.
Wow, I feel sorry for whoever gets the butter knife out of that set, I guess.
Yeah, so that's how it works. But we do have another trivia question coming up at the end of this episode and a different prize to give away. But before we get into that, JT, of course, we all are big supporters of emergency responders. Why don't you give a shout out to all those wonderful and brave men and women who keep us safe?
Yeah,
every day.
Shout out to our first responders, fire, hazmat, law enforcement, Back the Blue, customs, border protection, our military, in the Army, Navy, Marines, HUA, Air Force, and the Coast Guard.
Don't forget about Coast Guard. Yep. So, and all those three-letter agencies, CBP.
That shall remain unnamed.
TSA, FBI, NBA, MLB, Yeah, you name it. But no, God bless you folks. Thank you for everything you do. And hopefully you're listening and getting some out of the show. So let's get into the meat of this show, which is about white powders. Now, we're going to start off talking about, as I said, the white powders of, as it were, yesterday. So this is really post 9/11 and the subsequent anthrax attacks. And Dave, I know you have some interesting stuff to discuss there about this task force that was put together following these attacks and all the sort of the concerns that came about. So you want to just kind of start us off with that and we'll see where it goes?
Yeah. And so I kind of naturally lump both 9/11 and the Amerithrax attacks into one just large scale terrorist event, even though they were quite different in execution and obviously in the actors that perpetrated them, but roughly just because they happened so close to proximity that the nation really kind of rolled them together into one threat. Right, especially early on.
And our technology response was definitely due to both, that whole combination, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Amerithrax attacks, which is just kind of the nickname that was given to the anthrax attacks that occurred just 1 week after September 11th. In those attacks, five Americans were killed, with Robert Stevens of Florida being the first and probably the most covered, if you watched some of that news or have since seen documentaries on the event. Two employees of the Brentwood Mail facility, Thomas Morris Jr. and Joseph Kersine, were also killed. And I'm going to talk about the last two fatalities towards the end, just because they're a little bit of an interesting story. But overall, in addition to those five Americans who were killed, 17 or so were sickened. I've seen estimates in the 20s as well. It really just depends on the criterion that you use. But, you know, upwards of between that 17 to 20 number. So there were five letters that were sent through the mail, or five suspected letters were sent in wave one. Wave one was sent out of Trenton, New Jersey, probably about September 18th, 2001, just by the postage stamps or the postal marks. Thankfully, you know, when you use the U.S. mail to perpetrate acts of potential terrorism, it's actually quite well documented.
Of course,
There's that, you know. You're not going to get, like, the FedEx tracking updates on your terrorism, but you will have it well documented.
Well, we know how accurate those are when we're waiting in our hotel room to get a piece of equipment shipped to us, so that's a whole other topic.
Your WMD is out for delivery. Your WMD is out for delivery.
Yeah.
So those five letters, or the suspected letters, they were believed to have been sent to the ABC, CBS, NBC, the New York Post, and the National Enquirer. Of those, only the New York Post and the NBC letters were actually found. Two more letters were later found dated October 9th, so mailed about 2 weeks later. And these had been sent to two Democratic senators, Tom Daschle of South Dakota, who at the time was the Senate Majority Leader. And then
a very famous one.
And Patrick Leahy of Vermont, who at the time was the head of the Judiciary Committee. And so they were kind of high priority targets in this day and age. Daschle's letter was actually opened by an aide, while the Leahy letter was misdirected, allegedly due to the zip code being misread, which honestly is probably how all of my terrorist plots would be foiled. Like, I got a check minus on penmanship the whole way through grade school.
Exactly.
So just remember, use a stamp, you know, print legibly if you're going to perpetrate acts of mass terrorism. All right. So the investigation itself that lasted a really long time. So these all occurred in 2001, as I said. Actually, like a primary suspect wasn't even named until nearly 2007. But overall, so it was a really long investigation with not a lot of closure. There were some, you know, high profile leads. It was very well covered. And this, I think, really kept that threat level that we were talking about in the civilian world escalated at all times, right? Because we were in a war or entering a war over 9/11 itself. And so, you know, we had an entire country who was, you know, actively still seeking to do us harm in the back of our minds. But we also had this mysterious anthrax attack that was unsolved. And that meant that we weren't safe, right? That this could happen again at any point, anytime, anywhere. So the investigation itself involved 25 to about 30 full-time investigators from various federal agencies, including the FBI, the United States Postal Inspection Service. They have their own highly trained inspection service of federal, for the record, and a couple of other federal agencies as well. Those full-time investigators conducted over 80 searches. They recovered over 6,000 items of evidence, 5,730 environmental samples from 60 different site locations. So this was a massive long-term operation that involved a lot of evidence. And all that evidence needed to be analyzed either at point of contact in the field or certainly in the laboratories afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, Dave, a couple of key points there. So you said there were seven letters total involved in this, correct?
Suspected
letters. Yeah.
Right. And I believe four of them so far were actually found.
Yeah. So if you look at the big picture, right, that's not a lot, but of course, high profile, right? They were sent, as you said, news agencies and to some senators. Right. But ultimately, and again, one person dying is a tragedy, but the number of people, so five Americans were killed, a number more where you got sick. But again, in the big picture, it was more of the perceived threat versus the actual casualties that were occurring. Is that kind of a fair statement?
I think so. I think in particular that these attacks, both 9/11 and the Amerithrax attacks, were perpetrated against effectively civilians. Especially since, as I said, Robert Stevens was kind of the first face of this. So he was a civilian. He just, worked, I believe at one of the news agencies. I could be wrong on that. I apologize. But he was certainly the early face and he was just a civilian. You could make an argument whether or not we at the time viewed, congressmen as civilians. They are, for the record, and always have.
Yeah, they are.
And so, yes, right. I know occasionally we don't treat them as such, but they are in fact civilians. So there's again this perceived threat against just ordinary people. Whereas, prior to this, all of our wars have been somewhat conventional and not really domestic, with the exception of our domestic wars.
Yeah. And actually, I want to go, Jesse, prior to this, even in the mid to late 90s, there were some explosions, bombings like at the World Trade Center and all. Jesse, I don't know if you have any sort of flavor to add to that, but even that was sort of perceived as, well, the targets are these sort of high level targets, not, Joe Smith or Nancy, whatever, at her home. What do you think, JT?
Yeah. Those were the bombings of the World Trade Center and the USS Cole and some and the embassies in Africa. Yeah, those were high profile, visible targets, not really a lot of civilian, like the idea of a civilian population.
Right. Yeah. So what you're seeing, again, with this evolution of this now scare is basically anyone can be scared and potentially be a target because, terrorists, their whole thing is to inflict terror, inflict fear. And so, they could easily send a letter again to Joe Smith and then, oh my goodness, now we're all at risk. And that's kind of,
those white powder letters were really the big scare after the anthrax came out. Then any kind of letter with white powder, even if it wasn't intentional, and there were a lot of hoax threat letters that came out, but even when there was just like some type of normal white powder that would be associated with like letter. Yeah, it suddenly was perceived as a potential threat. And I think that's really where the technology response focused.
Yeah, and so this actually ties into the last two victims that I said I was going to discuss towards the end. And the reason where these two are particularly interesting is because they were just effectively, as far as we can tell, random civilians. So the last two victims were Kathy Nguyen, who lived in the Bronx, and then Audalie Lundgren, who lived in Oxford, Connecticut. As far as we know, they didn't seem to have any connection to known targets. There may have been additional letters that we don't know of, but from what I was able to see, and you know, like what the investigators found was that it was likely just incidental cross contamination from the anthrax letters themselves, either from just, you know, being pushed up next to them, or perhaps going through the mail sorting machines of the facilities. And this is really what triggered a lot of these technologies and just monitoring programs on our United States mail service, was the, you know, these cross contamination events, where it became very obvious that we needed to not only secure you know, buildings. It wasn't enough to just monitor the mail that came into federal buildings. We had to monitor the mail and the facilities as mail came into them across the nation.
Yeah, because those mail sorting facilities, they're processing, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of letters and things a day. And they have air handling systems and all that. And to your point, Dave, yeah, some simple cross-contamination from an actual, you know, bio-warfare agent, as it were, containing letter. You know, could get in there. So,
yeah, and they have they have employees to keep safe, even if it wasn't, you know, a national security concern. There's certainly, you know, a workplace safety concern, not just from legitimate terrorist threats like this, but, you know, just people send really unknown chemicals through the mail too. So, you know, don't do that. Follow guidelines. Don't expose other people to risk just because you feel like trying to ship lighter fluid somewhere.
Yeah, so that's the key point of today. Don't ship harmful chemicals in the mail. You learn nothing else on hazard glass. That's a key thing. Let's talk quickly about technology, though. That's where, again, we alluded to or got into in the first show about how FTIR, which was sort of in place for the field, but then really became into wide use following these, again, for these white powder calls, because let's be honest, again, on the statistics that you referred to, Dave, a vast majority of these white powders, you know, some grandma, you know, has some white powder in her kitchen, or, you know, at the bathroom at the local, you know, whatever restaurant, there's some white powder in the bathroom. These were not truly threats. And so the FTIR was a very useful, you know, a piece of technology to just identify it and say, okay, this is, you know, baking sugar, baking powder, whatever it is. It's still what I found in early days, people kind of relied on that too much, because you still had to potentially rule out the presence of a bio, you know, those things.
Right.
And so the infrared doesn't identify bio. That was one of the first questions we got when I was back at Sensors. Oh, hey, can your infrared identify anthrax? And I always said when I would do my trainings is infrared can't tell the difference between anthrax and egg whites. The sort of protein spectrum, as it were, is, at least for a field device, is not enough. But it was very useful. Then they came up with some bio kits. You know, some various assays and thing. There was a NIDS kit that came out, which you could do, again, to test a powder to see if there was bio. So it was very important to, again, start to employ that toolbox approach. But for the most part, these materials weren't hazardous. And let's kind of talk quickly about why. Number one, maybe Dave, how easy is it for a person who wants to inflict some terror to get, you know, viable anthrax?
I think viable is the key point there. But I just want to take a one step back and point out that I think this really speaks to what we've been talking about, is that the threat level changed, not the threats themselves. Because white powders were certainly being spilled before 9/11, before the Amerithrax attacks. And it wasn't a very large portion of the hazardous material technicians' call volume, one. And then two, to your point, there were technologies that could rule out bio threats. So if we were just concerned that it was, you know, anthrax, maybe one of those letters that we didn't yet find, a negative result from that kit should have been enough to de-escalate it. But it just wasn't, right? We needed to know, like, okay, well, what is this? And that's what FTIR does so well, is it is a great bulk detector for a lot of, you know, just general materials. It's got a very large library capacity. It's got a lot of documented research behind it. And, you know, it can very well answer, you know, what is this material mostly?
Yeah, exactly. And then that would allow agencies to say, you know, if it's a federal building, say, we ruled out bio and we determine based on this technology, it's, you know, baking soda. And then they say, okay, we can take some confidence in it to now reopen this facility or this airport terminal, whatever it was. And that was kind of the process. So we're going to... Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
But circling back to the question that you actually asked, it's very difficult to obtain viable anthrax in terms of its lethality. So anthrax occurs pretty naturally. It's found pretty commonly in areas where like sheep or cattle are herded and farmed. It's a pretty naturally occurring a biological agent, but you really need to kind of amp it up to the point where it's actually going to do harm to humans. And then if you're truly talking weaponized, you're probably building in some things like antibiotic resistance. And then there's obviously some preparation concerns that make it a little bit more weaponized. I'm not going to dig into those too deeply, just because of obvious reasons. But essentially you can get anthrax, but it's difficult to make it lethal and viable as a weapon without some background in at least pathology or, you know, biology.
And another interesting point, speaking of weaponization, we're talking about white powders. We use that term. Anthrax spores are not white.
No,
yeah,
right.
They're more like tan brown, right, JT?
Yeah.
So
they're off-white or of a darker color.
Typically, the weaponization, and again, we won't get into that, but would involve something that had more of a whitish color, and there's a whole other area of research there, but that's kind of where the white powder, and again, most of the powders, look at any powder in your kitchen, most of them are white. So that's kind of where we got this term white powder, but it's interesting that anthrax spores themselves, not white. But
how easy would it be if it were the brown powder calls? There'd be like four potential things that are brown. Like, no, this is definitely brown sugar.
That's pretty much it. All right.
This is guar gum.
So that's kind of a summary of those powder calls of, again, yesteryear. And to date, more recently, we haven't had any BWA, you know, sort of threats in the landscape. We're going to get into the white powders of today. Before we do that, we got to pay the bills, Dave and JT. So this is the ad copy that Alyssa gave me. So here we go. Real-time threats, real-time detection. The MX908 is a multi-mission tool utilized by elite responders, not lazy responders, not lousy responders, elite ones, right? Only the best. Conducting chemical, explosive, priority drug, and hazmat operations around the world. We talked about that on the first show. We're not actually all over the world yet, though. But, you know, Dave, you haven't been to, like, McMurdo Station, Antarctica, doing a training.
Is this your way of telling me that Antarctica has just bought a unit?
Yeah, Chris Carpita is working on a project there. But we're getting there.
Let's make sure it's in December, because that's how my travel arrangements work.
There you go. Trace level threat detection and discriminating selectivity. This is when discrimination is good, when you want to have selectivity among the chemicals, right? Having all that delivers real-time actionable intelligence in minutes. Is it minutes, Dave? Is it hours?
It's definitely not hours. Seconds to minutes, I think, is an accurate depiction.
Well, the ad copy says seconds, so I'm going with seconds.
That seems fair to me.
For more information, visit 908devices.com/MX908. That's 908devices.com/MX908. All right, let's talk about the white powders, as it were, of today. Now, some of the things we talked about, anthrax, obviously, Dave, as you indicated, that sort of escalated the perceived, at least public threat. There were some cases where some apparent, you know, just innocent civilians were targeted. Again, small amount, but still one is too many. But now we're talking about these synthetic opioids, which were originally developed for legitimate pharmaceutical use, still are today, but they sort of woven their way into the street drugs. And let's just use the term fentanyl, all right, as just a general term to talk about these synthetic drugs, although there's other types of synthetics, but we're just going to use fentanyl as sort of that name. And here's one of the key things, that one of the differences between fentanyl and anthrax, and Dave, how easy is fentanyl to get versus some viable anthrax?
I mean, I know a guy.
Well, yeah, you live in East Boston, so.
Yeah, no, so certainly fentanyl is much easier to get. Both, as you said, there's a robust, legitimate stream that was created for medical purposes, although, you know, from what we've seen, it's not necessarily being diverted to the street. You can get fentanyl through a number of ways. I think probably the most interesting way that one can get fentanyl is through the dark web. Yeah. And if you've never heard of the dark web, there's plenty of Netflix on it. But essentially, it is the side of the internet that you can't get to via Google, although you can actually Google how to get to dark web and you'll get a detailed instructions. Once you do so, you'll get an encrypted browser, maybe a destination that you'll type in directly, you know, via IP addresses, etc. And you'll find the latest bazaar of bad things. Silk Road, I think, is one of the more famous. There's numerous. They get taken down by the FBI quite frequently and other agencies. But essentially, it's eBay for bad guys. You can really search for any sort of goods or service that you wish. You can purchase them and hope it's not an undercover agent of some sort. But otherwise, you will get your crime of choice delivered to a location of your choice. And these days, you can pay for it all with Bitcoin.
Yeah,
those transactions are much easier.
Let me interrupt you there. You mentioned undercover. If you're talking to a potential client, let's say, and you're selling on the dark web, and that person's name is Leo,
Don't do that one. Again, and legally, if you ask, are you a cop, and they say no, they're not allowed to lie to you. That's what I've been told. So just remember, you always have to ask, TV. Are you a cop?
Yeah.
It's the only way to be sure.
Anyway, the dark web.
50% of the time, that works every time.
Absolutely. Are you a cop, JT?
Never know.
Remember, you can't lie.
But yeah, to your point, Dave, it's easy to get.
Yes.
And we don't want to get into the details here, but you know, it's you can find out ways to do it. Versus again, anthrax, which you basically have to, you know, not make it, but you know, grow it and all that, and get some viable spores. So that's one key difference. And of course, it's everywhere. Now you mentioned the anthrax related fatalities. You know, it's less than 10. How many fatalities are we seeing, you know, on a yearly basis from fentanyl overdoses, at least in the U.S.
That is a lot.
I think tens of thousands, right?
It's in the tens of thousands. Now, when we say that, these are not necessarily terrorist attacks. These are individuals taking these street drugs unwittingly, known that they're, you know, they have this lethal amount, but there is concern about this material because of its ease of use to get and its lethality to use it for that. Yeah, go ahead, JT.
Yeah, now we're having these white powder concerns where, like you said, there's this lethal material that might be in someone's kitchen or in the mail, and it does come in the form of a white powder this time.
It actually is a white powder.
Can also be a brown powder. So I guess we wouldn't have escaped our brown powder calls either, unfortunately.
Yeah. And it actually, some of the drugs they put on the street, they'll actually make them look brown because people who want heroin expect it to be brown.
You know,
like tan. But then there's actually fentanyl in it. It's crazy. So it's a big problem, but for the most part, really are white powders. And the big thing here is white powders of today. Again, you go to someone's residence, there's a white powder, much bigger chance if you're an emergency responder, you're dealing with something acutely toxic versus, you know, going back to the anthrax scares. And that's another thing, Dave, I just wanted to quickly talk about the difference in sort of onset of symptoms. So if you're exposed to some viable anthrax spores versus exposed to a lethal dose of, let's just say, fentanyl, that's a big difference in terms of time, right?
Yeah. And so one of the interesting things there is that the most lethal route probably for a responder in both situations is inhalation, right? Obviously, anthrax is... You can get a cutaneous infection, but the dangerous one is, you know, really the inhaled version. And that's true for responder in the case of fentanyl as well. We talked a lot about the skin route of exposure, but really the danger from fentanyl is inhaling aerosolized powders or ingesting it either, you know, accidentally, you know, like by touching your face or your mouth after you've touched powder, things of that nature. But certainly the onset for the symptoms for fentanyl are very, very quick. That's really what it was designed to be. It was a breakthrough pain medication. We use it for, you know, fast acting pain release and also for time release in the patches. But medically, it kicks in very, very quickly. It's what they use to like initiate anesthesia often during surgeries, and then they'll balance it out a little afterwards. But it's very fast acting as opposed to a bioagent. I don't know the specific onset of symptoms for anthrax, but certainly any sort of bioagent, we're typically talking days to, you know, a week. One of the things that makes, you know, COVID so problematic for us is that our onset of symptoms is, you know, 1 to 2 weeks.
Yeah, there's an incubation period, right? I mean, you got to wait for it to sort of grow in your body and start to do its thing.
Yeah. If it was a faster incubation period, it would actually be much easier to react to.
Yeah. So those are a few of the differences. And then I kind of mentioned the detection technology. So the FTIR of the 2000s, that was fantastic for identifying white powders. And we were sort of in a good place at a good time, the right place at the right time, to have a technology to just do this identification. You know, one of the most important libraries we developed in the early days on the Hazmat AD was the white powder library. We went to the Stop and Shop and just bought a bunch of stuff and put it in the library so you could identify this stuff. Now the MX908, which 908 Devices produces, is kind of like that in terms of it has that capability with a drug hunter to identify these fentanyls and other synthetic drugs, but at those trace levels. Because Dave, as you know, it's not, God forbid, it's not pure fentanyl you're seeing in a dime bag or something. It's cut pretty heavily. It's got to be because it's so lethal.
Yeah, so the lethal dose of fentanyl is about 2.56-ish milligrams, and the, you know, analgesic dose is like 100 micrograms, which are both fairly invisible quantities. You can probably see a milligram. You can't really see much in the way of a microgram. But the point is that it's incredibly small quantities of this drug is what you would encounter in the user form. Now, you certainly can encounter pure packages of fentanyl, sure. And these are particularly dangerous to the responder and, again, to the male system. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a good parallel as well, is that, as we've mentioned, a lot of these pure materials are literally being shipped in through the mail from overseas. We won't mention any countries in particular, but certainly a lot of it is being shipped in to us for domestic cutting and then distribution. And so again, this presents a really big hazard for postal employees, as well as first responders and, you know, people who get other people's mail by accident. But I think that's a good point. So when you encounter pure fentanyl, the FTIR and the Raman are still going to do pretty good jobs of identifying that that's potentially a fentanyl, or an analog of fentanyl or a synthetic opioid. But to your point, that's not how it's distributed. It's not how it's taken. And it's not how you're likely to encounter it, certainly at an overdose. And so where would those technologies roughly be able to cut off in terms of that detection, Mark?
Yeah.
Your expertise.
Well, I'm going to mention that, and then JT, I'm going to talk to you about training. But yeah, so generally speaking, for FTIR, they say within a mixture, you can't detect a component that's less than about 10% weight by weight. Of course, there's different. There's weight by weight, volume by volume, all of that. And I could talk for another 10 minutes on how that came about, but it's about 10%. Raman, it's about 5%. But you're looking at that, you know, 5 to 10% level where fentanyl on the street is usually cut down to that about 1 to 3% if you're lucky and it's not going to kill you. So that's kind of where it is. But Jesse, relative to training, I mentioned the toolbox approach, even going back to the FTIR and using bioassays. It's very important these days to use your multiple technologies to get a full picture. And that's kind of how you approach your training, right?
Oh, yeah. Like a holistic approach, because like you mentioned, there's so many different technologies available to the first responder that have different capabilities and different limitations, and there's some overlaps. And so to get a good picture of what is a threat material, what can be ruled out as a non-hazardous material. The toolbox approach is essential. And so training has to take that into consideration. So definitely our approach to training is, where does the MX in our particular case currently, where does it fit into the toolbox, and how does it work in complement with other technologies and techniques? So it's not like a standalone piece of equipment, because
right.
no agency or none of our customers have one piece of kit.
Yeah. And it's not even just the technology, right, Dave? It's the totality of an event. Again, you show up, have an overdose, a patient revived with Narcan, for example. That tells you something. Going back to anthrax, there's a letter mailed to Senator Daschle. Yeah, that's potentially more threatening than a powder that was spilling out of a letter that came from, the mortgage company that, was sent to, Mrs. Smith, sort of thing. You kind of have to look at the big picture, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I totally thought you were going to say totality of the circumstances.
Sorry, I made up my own.
No, that's really important. I think the best way I've ever heard that described is, don't take your brain out. Right? Mm-hmm. It's not about just using technology. You, the operator, are really responsible for assessing the situation, making hypotheses, and then using the technologies to support or deny those hypotheses. You're still in charge of this scene. The technology is not in charge of you, certainly.
Yeah. So we're kind of running up to time to wrap up, but just to summarize, going back to white powders of anthrax and looking at the white powders today, similarities, you got to use a toolbox approach. You got to use the totality of the circumstances. Jesse, I'll use your phrase.
Oh, that's not my phrase.
Well, it's someone's phrase, and I just used it.
It's a good one.
And you just kind of have to understand, what your technologies can and can't do and how they can all fit together. And we'll be talking more into those specifics in some other shows. But we're going to wrap up with this one. And we do have another trivia question. This one's a little different. So last week was sort of about, qualitative analysis. This one's specific to 908 devices, not about our products, but this is a tricky one. And if you can get this one, listeners, you deserve a prize. So,
oh yeah.
Yeah. Here's the question. So 908 devices, the name 908 devices comes from the physics of mass spec and sort of ion trap dynamics. And 908, is a number that comes from that. So here's the question. Now, if you know our logo, get our website, 908devices.com. You'll see it everywhere. The logo. It's kind of like, what would you say, Dave? Like a couple little ovals.
I think any way I describe this will not be in line with our corporate imaging. So you guys can Google that one for yourself.
The ovals represent the trajectories of the ions in the trap. But then he's got a little head, a little dot above the ovals. That's his head of the ion man, we call him. Here's the question. What is the significance of the head on the Iron Man in that 908 devices logo?
That's a good one.
I'll give you a hint. Again, that 908 number, which comes from physics, is a ratio of two parameters in physics that is less than one. Is that a good hint? So, if you know math, think about it. So what's the significance of the head in the Iron Man? If you know the answer, or even if you don't, send an email to hazardclass@908devices.com. That's hazard with one Z, class@908devices.com. And what's in the prize closet this week, Alyssa? Yeah, we actually got the 908 oven mitts in, Jesse.
Yes.
They came. They were on back order, but they look fantastic. They're Gore-Tex. So they are,
That doesn't sound very safe.
Well, that's what I was told. That was what I was told. They're ultra, heat resistant, and they're fantastic. And again, any comments, show ideas, whatever, send them to us at hazardclass@908devices.com. This has been fun. Dave, any last words before we wrap up?
No, I'm good. Actually, so fun fact, the anthrax letters actually had a letter in them telling the responder what the material inside of them was. So for all of you other white powder people who are spilling your white powders everywhere, be courteous. Leave a note with exactly what the white powder is for your responding agencies.
Yeah, that's just nice. That's common just common courtesy. Yeah, makes sense. How about you, JT?
Label your WMDs.
Yeah. JT, anything before we wrap up?
Keep safe out there, and training is on us, but practice is on you.
Mm. You talk about practice. Practice, practice, practice. Thanks so much for listening, folks. Tune in next time for another episode of Hazard Class, the show where, if you're not careful, Jesse,
you just might learn something.
Exactly. Take care, folks. We'll see you next time.
Well, that's it. Hazard Class dismissed.